Hello and welcome to Imperial College Business School's podcast, Inside Out, with your host Varun Bakshi. Inside Out focuses on ideas, academic work and perspectives within the business school and how all of that relates to the world outside. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Michelle Drokin, who's the Associate Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship. I was privileged enough to be on her class, which was Innovation and Entrepreneurship for the full-time MBA, and I can easily stick my neck out and say that was one of the best classes that I'd attend. And here she is, Professor Rogan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Varun. What a nice introduction. I really appreciate that. And it's good to be here with you today.
Yes. And I truly mean that. I'm not trying to flatter you by saying innovation and entrepreneurship was, in all honesty, one of the most challenging classes, I have to admit, because you consistently expected us to be on top of our game. But looking back, I can easily say that that was a fascinating class.
I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you.
I wanted to dive right in to entrepreneurship to begin with. Can you give us a sense of how much of entrepreneurship is personality driven? And can entrepreneurship be taught? Because if you look at some of the best entrepreneurs that have existed, the likes of Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, they all have an edge about them that has undoubtedly translated into very, very successful companies. But do you believe that entrepreneurship can also be taught to an individual?
Well, of course, yes. I'd have to be questioning my choice of career if I were worried that it couldn't be taught. So yes, absolutely, entrepreneurship can be taught. And your question about whether it's personality driven actually links back to a longstanding debate within research on entrepreneurship. So scholars taking a perspective from psychology might look at personality characteristics as correlates of entrepreneurial behavior. But the perspective that I come from is driven more by sociology, where we think about the context, the networks, the situation that people are in, and then how that creates a space where they can act entrepreneurially. What types of things do we need to put in place for that person to be more of an entrepreneur? And that, I think, really underlines the way that at Imperial we teach about entrepreneurship. So thinking about how to help people understand what behaviors they need to engage in and what characteristics of their environment will make it easier or harder for them to engage in those behaviors.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, because is that why we see Silicon Valley consistently churn out some of the most enterprising companies? Because the environment is so conducive for tech entrepreneurship.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, you know, that's been the subject of a lot of research and plenty of countries and different city areas have been trying to mimic what happens in Silicon Valley. It's a real mix of factors, though. It's hard to point to one. And I think that's why other areas have struggled so much to imitate that. You brought up another point, too, about some of the, I'll call them celebrity entrepreneurs that we read about in the press. And I think we have to be careful when we draw conclusions about what really drives entrepreneurship if we only use these examples, because they're not actually really representative of the full range of entrepreneurs that exist in the world, mm-hmm. right? They're the ones that the press likes to write about because they're a bit sensational and they're interesting. But there are plenty of people that are being very successful entrepreneurs, smart people that understand how to develop and deliver value to customers that need it.
So we also had an interesting debate when it came towards integrating entrepreneurship within the workplace. And this was a debate that was initiated during your lecture, and some were for, some were against this. What is the short-term and long-term impact of having a startup environment in every business? Because a lot of established businesses, matured businesses today, are wanting to have that culture, possibly because they're competing with so many startups across the globe, you know, vying for that same talent. But can you give us some sense of the impact of integrating entrepreneurship within the workplace?
I mean, the question about integrating entrepreneurship, it's a really complex one. there are many ways we can think about integrating it, and the way that that's done can vary dramatically. So you could think about integrating it in a fairly minimal way, where you might have a corporate venture capital unit that invests in startups. So from thinking about how the firm is using its financial resources, then investing some of those in entrepreneurial activity can happen that way. But that sort of approach doesn't require integration for every employee, right? That's fairly separate, and a separate structure for that. But then at the other extreme, we have companies who are really thinking about how to change the mindsets of employees to become more entrepreneurial. And that requires a real rethink of how the company operates, right? So what kinds of behaviors are rewarded? What kinds of resources and support are provided to employees? What types of employees are hired into the firm? What types of employees get promoted? And that becomes a much more difficult transition for companies that don't already have that sort of mindset. And it also becomes something very critical as, for companies that do have that approach to entrepreneurship, to be able to protect as their businesses grow. There's a whole range. I think it's interesting you said that there was a debate. There are some that would say that it's very hard to bring entrepreneurial thinking into the same environment that is designed to drive efficiency in the business, right? And I think that kind of underlies the core challenge that a lot of companies face. So striking that balance between entrepreneurship and efficiency, that's where it gets really tricky. Companies have done that either by just saying, okay, we'll have some engages with startups either through a CVC or having a separate kind of incubator within the corporate. Or there are a few that have actually found ways to really embed that entrepreneurial thinking in their culture. So I think in our class, we talked about 3M as one example of a company that had done that very well. 3M, it's they're hard to imitate, right? It's a culture that they've developed over decades and something that they guard carefully and nurture carefully. It'll be interesting to see as some of the younger companies that we look at, like companies like, Netflix comes to mind, for example, as these companies mature, or Spotify could be another example, if they're actually going to be able to develop into that sort of system and culture that we see within 3M, something that would be standing the test of time and actually institutionalizing entrepreneurship, rather than just having it be something that's done on the side, which we see a lot of companies also doing.
Right. You're talking about the duopoly that exists within these firms, right? Where you're talking about efficiency on one end, and then there's entrepreneurship on the other end. Is the idea of entrepreneurship to primarily drive innovation?
Yes and no. And I think of entrepreneurship as I have sort of a Venn diagram in my mind, if you could imagine. Entrepreneurship as one circle, innovation as the other. There's definitely an overlap between the two of those, but we can think about entrepreneurial activity that may be lower on innovation. Someone could take an existing idea that's been proven in one marketplace, in one country, for example, and then start a business using that same product idea, but launching it in another country. That's highly entrepreneurial. You might question how innovative it is, but it's highly entrepreneurial. And then at the other extreme, we could think about innovations to products within a corporation that may not be entrepreneurial. They're not necessarily about starting a new business or generating new revenues. They're rather innovations that help improve the durability of the product or the reliability of a product. I think where entrepreneurship becomes interesting and where we see businesses that are more likely to succeed are where those two circles overlap in the middle of the Venn diagram. So finding those entrepreneurial opportunities that are based on a core innovation that will bring some novel value to customers, addressing some unmet need that, you know, and then being harder to imitate as well because of the innovation underlying the business idea.
Yeah. Yeah. This is very interesting again, because Peter Thiel consistently goes back to exactly that, which is, it's good if you're starting out, but it's only good if you're starting out if that venture truly rethinks or reimagines the way things currently operate or work. Because if that's not the case, then you're merely just going to be eventually part of the competition, because somebody is going to imitate you, which will drive your profits down, meaning you just become another cog in the wheel.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's nothing wrong with if you see an opportunity where, you know, maybe it's something that just at that moment in time, you can come up with a product that meets a need and you can get it out there. You can definitely create value and capture some of that value in the near term. Those sorts of businesses may not be the ones that stand the test of time. Perhaps they are also the ones that wouldn't attract as much venture capital funding. But, you know, if you look at the data, you know, going back to this question of does entrepreneurship equal innovation, what would we consider entrepreneurship? I'm not sure of the current statistic, but I know that in the past, if we look at the percentage of entrepreneurial ventures that receive venture capital funding, it's about 15%, right? There are a lot of companies that don't actually need to take venture capital funding, some that actually are generating profitable revenue from the start. And, you know, for those business owners, they're actually in a sweet spot of not actually having to give away part of their company and being able to just grow the business on the back of the revenues that they're already generating. I can think of two companies off the bat for that. So one company that started in North Carolina, which is a SaaS, the founder of that company, I think he never took any he never gave any equity away outside of his core group of co-founders. And another one is an insurance company in the US called Plymouth Rock that, if I recall as well, the founder there, you know, he had investors, but he wasn't seeking venture capital funding in the way that we think of today, where, you know, everybody's pulling their deck together and going out and pitching for funding from VCs. It's important to keep in mind there are a lot of different ways that you can fund your business without going down that route.
Yeah. Yeah. If I may, there's also MailChimp that's existed for a decade plus that's never had any funding.
That's a great example. Yeah, absolutely. I love that example. That's a good one. Yep. Yep, for sure. And we do see, I think, the rise of crowdfunding there. And there are also relative to where things were, you know, 10, 20 years ago, even within the venture funding world, there are many more groups out there looking to fund ventures. We have much more robust networks of angel investors than we would have had in the past. We have a breed of firms that are not the pure VCs, but more of what you'd call venture builders, like Blenheim Shalcott in London, you know, is one of those where they provide much more operational support than what we'd think of with the old style VC. So I think, you know, it's exciting right now because there are so many different ways you could think about funding your venture. So that's just more opportunities to try and engage in entrepreneurial activity after you finish up at Imperial.
Yeah. Yeah. Imperial does have a tremendous focus on entrepreneurship. For anybody listening. Yep. That's advertisement there. Yep.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
All right. You've been exploring the role of gender and networks in entrepreneurial entry and career mobility. Can you walk us through that, please?
Yeah, I think you know, it's an interesting segue on from talking about funding. So if we look at patterns of historically, sort of patterns of who goes into entrepreneurship, of those that do, who gets funding, who gets VC funding, there's been a consistent pattern where women tend to have a harder time getting funding for their ventures. One of the, you know, there are a lot of explanations that could explain that. But one of the factors that I'm most interested in is understanding how the networks that we as entrepreneurs have affect, you know, how much we know about where funding opportunities are, how much we know about where to get the resources that we need, how, you know, if we have network ties to key people, how likely they are to refer us to other people who can help us. And, you know, because of, you know, longstanding biases that we have in most societies, sometimes those networks that women entrepreneurs have just don't deliver the same benefits to them as they would for male entrepreneurs. Now, what's exciting is there are some really cool platforms, interesting activities going on to try and help bridge that gap. So one in particular that I've gotten to know a lot about recently is called Alice. This is a platform, it's based in the US right now, and that's Alice as in, you know, Alice in Wonderland. Alice is, and the website is actually helloalice.com. Mm-hmm. It's a platform that the founder, Carolyn Rods, put in place to try and overcome the constraints that women face, and minority founders as well, not only the challenges associated with being a woman, but also with being a minority, and either being excluded from those key networks and information that entrepreneurs need, or not being able to, for example, you know, if you are a young, unmarried, with very few limitations, and you had a business you wanted to grow, you might just pick up and relocate yourself to Silicon Valley so you could be in the center of the action. But for a lot of other entrepreneurs, that's just not possible. So with Alice, you know, they're trying to use technology on this platform to overcome some of those constraints. So they're doing a lot of exciting things there. You know, in my own research, I'm trying to understand what we can do, what kind of interventions we can take to help women who do found ventures be more successful as they go through that. I wish I could give you lots of great insights into that, but it's very much a work in process. So, you know, with my collaborators, we're just now collecting some data on the networks of entrepreneurial founders to understand what are the key factors that are going to drive different outcomes for people. So stay tuned is my, so my final point. Stay tuned, please. More is coming.
Right. One of the stories that really sticks out for, to me is that of Melanie Perkins, who is the founder of Canva, which is a graphic design tool. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, she's based in Australia. Her story is fascinating because when she started the company, she was struggling to find funding because, you know, Australia is typically not associated with being a tech innovation hub. And so Melanie would consistently travel to San Francisco just in the hope that she could get her idea funded. And I think there were multiple times that she ended up in San Francisco going, just knocking on doors. And well, initially there was a very cold response from VCs and angel investors because, you know, why are we going to fund an idea based out of Sydney? But they were open to speaking to her, gave her feedback on what the product should look like. And every single time she went back having incorporated feedback into the product and then saying, hey, look, I've done what you asked me to. Can I get funded? And today Canva is a unicorn. And it's an incredibly interesting story because of the sheer persistence that this woman had.
Yeah. I mean, that story is uplifting and also worrying at the same time, because I can't help but wonder if Melanie had been Matthew instead of Melanie, if she might have received a different response from the venture capital groups, right? So unfortunately, we found in experimental studies that there is evidence of bias against female founders when they present, you know, the controlled studies where the business idea is absolutely identical, and they'll have that idea presented by a female founder, and then in another instance presented by a male founder, and so everything's controlled for except for the gender of the presenter. And in those cases, the women are significantly less likely to receive that funding.
I was itching to step in because, you know, whenever we talk about inequality or biases, I think it's human for us to put our hands up and say, oh, I definitely don't feel like that, or I don't think that way. But to us, and when I mean us, I'm talking about the MBA cohort, this was self-evidenced when we did the Heidi Howard experiment in class, right? We were all caught off guard. So for those who aren't aware, Heidi Howard is a simple experiment where there are two profiles that we had to go over, which were identical, just that the names differed, where one document took on a female and one male. And sure enough, there was a bias towards the male candidate here, because, you know, he was perceived to be more magnanimous and generous when it came to network effects, whereas Heidi, on the other hand, was perceived to be more cutthroat and too competitive in her workplace. I mean, it really, that was such an eye-opener, because it really, you know, it's almost like standing in front of the mirror and somebody talks back to you. Yeah. How far do you think are businesses from being egalitarian, though?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you found that experiment eye-opening. I think it's just a great way to get an honest discussion going among the class about the role that bias and unconscious bias plays. How does that sort of play out in organizations today? How far do we have to go? I think we still have a long way to go. I've been encouraged by my interactions with people in the business community in London since I moved to London a year ago. For example, talking to a venture capital group, at the moment they actually haven't invested in any ventures that are led by female entrepreneurs, but they actually see that as an issue. And I think a few years ago, they may not have. So now they're very interested to learn from what they're doing and understand, well, what do we need to change about the way that we're operating our business to bring more diversity into the venture? So not only diversity in terms of, is the venture leader female or a minority, but also thinking about the composition of the venture teams, right? So you can still have significant diversity on the teams themselves, even if you still have a non-minority founder, if the other people on the founding team represent different nationalities, cultures, religions, genders, then we're already making progress in that way. So I'm very much encouraged by that. We need to keep in mind that it's not just about changing the way that systems view women, the way that others view women. It's also about changing the systems for men. So providing more discretion, more latitude for men to take on non-traditional roles is equally important. I do think we need to take very seriously the effects of the coronavirus lockdown on some of these issues around gender equality in organizations, because this disruption is definitely being borne more heavily by working mothers, like, you know, parents of young kids, and primarily on mothers more than fathers, because we do, you know, we still have our behavioral patterns that are fairly deeply ingrained, some more so in some cultures more so than others. And the fact that, you know, lockdown has put us in this very constrained and difficult situation, I think, unfortunately, is exacerbating this a bit. So I think that the need for organizations to take this seriously is actually increased over the past months. And I hope that they do, because there's, yeah, a lot we need to still move forward on.
Well, that's a great nugget that you're leaving us with. Before I call curtains on this episode, it's tradition that we always get the guests to recommend for our listeners one book. So if there's any book that you're currently reading or have read in the past that you'd love to recommend.
Oh, that's a tough one. So I'm going to go with one that I was just writing up for a module outline I'm preparing for a class this autumn. There's a great book called Creativity Inc., which is written by Ed Catmull. So Creativity Inc., it's a story of Pixar and how Pixar developed this culture that really supports creativity. And it's a wonderful story, really entertaining, but also full of great things that are actually easy to, well, not easy. You can imagine actually taking some of these points and trying to put them in place in your own organization. So I would highly recommend Creativity Inc. to anyone interested in learning more about driving creativity inside their company.
Excellent. I think we've also come a full circle with Pixar and Steve Jobs. That's a wrap here. See you in the next one.